I want to welcome everyone to our Keeping on Track open line. We're celebrating 25 years in business and just entering our 12th year of doing open line programs. We have a few new exciting changes. First, we have our new 2019 open line format that comes with the launching of our new website. You can also find an archive of past topics on our publication event tab. Our third book, thanks to Barry, Barry pushed me to, or us to do our first book. We're on our third book now. Cracking the High Performance Team Code is now available, and we also offer skills testing and 360s, which has been a huge hit with our clients. Our topic today is, it's always time to raise the hiring bar. My name is Dana Barocca. I'm the CEO of Lighthouse Consulting Services. I'll be hosting our program today. We have just a few housekeeping items, so we'll jump right into our topic. For those of you joining us for the first time at Lighthouse, everything we do goes back to our mission statement, bringing effective insight to your organization. We do this through our in-depth work style and personality assessments to raise the hiring bar and assist companies with a variety of services, including skills testing, 360s, interpersonal coaching, team building, stress management workshops, and much more. We have an office in Taiwan and the UK, so if you have an operation in Asia or Europe and would like to get leadership coaching for them or providing ideas for how to best interact with a US-based company, please let us know. Our Keeping on Track open line series is always in response to a number of calls we've been getting from many of our clients, both domestically and globally, to address business issues that organizations are facing today. Our goal is to make this an interactive program, so on your screen you'll see an area you can send questions or ideas during our discussion. We'll attempt to respond to as many of you as possible, so please join us with your thoughts and insights along the way. At the conclusion of our program, we'll open up the line so you can talk directly with our guests. So during our program, write down two or three questions you have, and you can send those in through the chat box or at the end of our program. I want to introduce a longtime friend, business colleague, very cool guy, and a true expert on the topic of hiring. Barry Deutsch is a well-known thought leader in hiring and peak performance management. He is a frequent and sought-after speaker for management meetings, trade associations, and CEO forums such as Vistage International, which is a worldwide CEO membership organization with more than 20,000 CEOs and senior executives. Many of his clients view Barry as their virtual chief talent officer. Barry is also frequently asked to present Impact Hiring Solutions, which is award-winning programs on hiring, retention, and motivating top talent, and leverages a vast knowledge of based of 30 years in the executive search field. With a track record of successful placements in multi-billion dollar Fortune 500 companies, entrepreneurial firms, and mid-market high-growth businesses, Barry has worked closely with thousands of CEOs and key executives to help improve the hiring success, leverage human capital, and raise the bar on talent acquisition. Barry earned his BA and MA from the American University in Washington, D.C. prior to his executive search career. Barry held positions of responsibility in finance and general management with Mattel, Beatrice Foods, and Westinghouse Cable. I feel truly privileged to have Barry with us again on Open Line to share ideas of how you can deal with the hiring issue, which never ends. Also, registration for our next program will begin at the end of today's program. The topic will be the secrets of high-performance growth companies, how best-in-breed organizations are separated from the pack. Today, before Barry starts, I just want to mention, we're not going to have a slide deck, so you'll be seeing it's always time to raise the hiring bar on the screen, and that's not going to change, but you can use the chat box for sharing ideas. Barry, welcome back to OpenLine.
Thank you very much, Dana. I'll say, since we're not using a slide deck in the presentation, what I'll do for everyone that registered is I'll send them a copy of the slide deck that I use for our advanced interviewing program. I'll send them a complimentary copy of our book that's got a specific chapter on how to interview more effectively, which is many of the points that we're going to talk about in our 30, 40 minutes together today.
And Barry's book, I recommend, All right, Carl Barry's book, The Bible of Hiring. I've been saying that for years. It's an amazing book, and it's very nice of Barry to offer that to everybody. It's entitled You're Not the Person I Hired.
So, Dana, how do you want to do this? Do you want to take questions as they come up through the course of this, or do you want to save them all to the very end?
Let's see how it goes, probably as they come up.
You just feel free to interrupt me at any time if you want to, you know, hey, Barry, here's someone's asking this question.
Okay, perfect.
All right. So let's start with, first of all, we're going to talk about raising the bar, but we're going to specifically focus it around interviewing. This is, for 30 years I've been doing this with my clients, consulting and executive search. I've worked with thousands of companies, and I'm just astounded at the mistakes that get made in interviewing. To some degree, I think it's a little bit of what I'll call the tribal approach to hiring. You all familiar with the tribal approach? That's where we keep doing the same things because I learned it from the old guy who learned it from the dead guy. You know, we just perpetuate it generation after generation. Doesn't mean it's the right thing to do. And the biggest issue I find in interviewing is that, there's a couple of issues. Number one, first impressions tend to overwhelm and dictate everything that happens. So because we don't have a very rigorous process in place, interview guides, specific questions, how to document what we hear from candidates, a scoring tool that allows us to compare hiring manager assessment to candidates and in different matrices. Because we don't have that rigor and we don't wrap other pieces around it, then first impressions tend to dominate. And my experience is that most of the quantifiable studies that have been done over the last quarter of a century show that 85% or more of the reason people get hired has absolutely nothing to do with their competency, skills, ability, performance. It's based on chemistry, rapport, and likability. And so if we accept that, and again, there's lots of research on this, then we look at the question of when we sit with candidates and they're sitting across the table from us, what are we observing? Are we seeing who the real person is? And when I ask this question in my more extended workshops that I do for 3 or 4 hours, the vast majority of people tell me that what we're not seeing is who the real person is and what they're capable of. We're seeing actors and actresses. And some people are better at it than others. For example, I might post to you how many of you have ever been involved in a hiring decision. I shouldn't say how many of you have been involved. I should say how often has this happened. How many of you have seen where a great interviewer who says all the right things, whether you're hiring a senior executive or a process operator in front of a press piece of equipment in a plant, they say all the right things in the interview, and then they come aboard and face plant on the ground. The flip side of that is how many of you have ever interviewed a candidate who was shy, reserved, cautious, uncomfortable, nervous, uptight, and you saw a little spark, you decided to take a risk, and lo and behold, they turned out to be one of your better candidates. Most people tell me these two things happen. So one question is how do we burst through that facade and get to see who the real person is? Well, I'm assuming that because you're on this call, you're using the 16PF and Dana and Ellen at Lighthouse Consulting to help you get to the personality side of it. And most of my clients would tell me that's as important as the performance traits, and I would agree with that. So that's a different subject. Dana and Ellen can cover that for you. I assume you're all using that and effectively on being successful with it. We're going to talk more about why do we fail to hire people who can do the job? Why does that fall apart? Again, first impressions is an issue around that. Desperation hiring tends to play a role. So when the job's been open for a while, at about the 4-week point where work's not getting done, things are falling through the cracks, the manager's doing part of that job, everybody's frustrated, you've run an ad, and in the last 30 days, all you pulled were all the deadbeats, rejects, retreads, dysfunctional, toxic non-performers, and you realize you're probably not going to see any better people than the ones you've already seen. Now what do we do? The hiring manager now lowers their standards, dummies down the job, and their thought process goes from, let me hire the very best person I can for this role, to let me just get a warm body in there because a body is better than nobody. So one key element of preventing desperation hiring from taking place is to make sure you've got enough people in the top of the funnel that are good candidates. That's a separate conversation. We're going to talk about once the folks are in that funnel, what do we do? One of the other elements that we have to overcome is embellishment, exaggeration, and lying. So again, one of the questions that I pose frequently to the groups I make my presentations to is, think back now, last couple of years, of all the people you've met in the interview process, what percentage outright lied to you, embellished, or exaggerated? And the vast majority of people tell me 100%. 100%. Actually, I think it's about 120 to 140%.
That's
so now you're
number.
Probably thinking, that's silly. How does he come up with a number like that? It's because people do it more than once. 13 times on the job application, 14 times on the resume, 22 times in the phone interview. It's multiple and it's compounded. So the question then becomes is, how do we get at the truth? And in a few minutes, I'm going to show you two simple techniques for which there isn't a candidate on earth that can make this stuff up fast enough. They've either done it and can describe it to you in clear, precise, sufficient detail, or they will literally self-implode in the chair in front of you. You're going to want to slap yourself in the forehead over how simple this is, but these two techniques will allow you to get to the truth every single time. I'm going to hold that for a moment just so I can keep your attention focused for about the next 30 minutes. Last one, the criteria that we're using to base our questions upon are flawed. We're using the wrong measurement, criteria, description, characterization of what we want from people, and as a result, it leads us to the wrong interview questions. I would say that probably 70 to 80% of the time, I find my clients are still asking what I call the 20 standard, stupid, inane, canned interview questions that go something like, tell me about yourself. Why are you here today? What do you know about us? What are your strengths? What are your weaknesses? We love people who work in teams and like to collaborate. How do you feel about teams? And as a result, we get a lot of canned responses that people have practiced. So how do you measure whether people can actually do the job? So let's jump into a couple of items right away. First, I think the entire interview is flawed because it is an artificial environment. It does not measure whether someone can do the job. It measures whether someone can talk about doing the job. And talking about it versus doing it is a dramatically different scenario. So my very first recommendation is that from this day forward, no matter what the job is, secretarial, press operator in the plant, customer service rep, sales manager, chief operating officer, doesn't matter what the level is, every candidate should get some practical assessment, a hands-on view of can you do the work. And it's different at each of those levels, but the concept is the same. Everybody should get a test, hands-on test of whether they can do the job. And this should represent roughly about a third of your entire interview assessment. So let's go through each of these for example. Let's take where most of the mistakes occur is at the bottom of the ladder because we spend the least amount of time in the interview doing this. And so we make a lot of mistakes because we're just not willing to interview people for enough time to measure whether they can do the job. You're hiring a customer service rep. Instead of spending 40 minutes asking the 20 standard stupid and canned interview questions, I think at least a third and probably more of that interview should be a role play. You sit on that side of the desk and pick up the imaginary phone. I'll sit on this side, and let's go through the 13 scenarios you're going to face every single day from one of our customers. You're hiring a low-level accountant or bookkeeper in your financial shop, your accounting department, and one of their responsibilities is going to be to do a monthly bank reconciliation. Instead of discussing doing the bank rec in the interview, put them in an office, give them Excel, hand them your last bank statement, and stand over their shoulder while they reconcile that bank statement. I have a client down in Houston. They're a marine welder. 80% of the people they hire are marine welders. They strap on these heavy pieces of equipment, and they weld large steel plates together in the oil and gas shipping marine industry. Their failure rate was over 50%. It was a 20-minute interview, 20 to 30-minute interview of asking people questions about welding, then they'd hire someone. and the vast majority couldn't do what they said they could do. So my client redesigned the interview to be nothing more than a series of four significant welds that represented over 85% of the work they would be doing, and their accuracy went right through the ceiling because they made the interview resemble real work. You're hiring a numerical control operator for your machining operation. You've got a $1 million lathe that has to be programmed to cut out of a titanium stock. Instead of sitting in the interview discussing the setup, the jig, how they're going to do it, position it, how it relates to the blueprints, pull out the blueprints, go through those together, make them set up a jig to align the titanium stock with the cutting head, and have them program the machine. Force everyone to do what's required in the job. And my experience has been in most jobs, there are 3 to 4 primary metrics of success, no matter what the job is. The tough question is, how do we design something that's going to measure practical work experience? It shouldn't be hypothetical. It shouldn't be made up. It should be something they're going to have to do on the job. You're hiring someone who has to do a lot of writing in the marketing department. There should be some kind of writing test. Ask them to prepare a memo, a proposal for a client, a compelling piece of advertising. Whatever the job is, the test should be the practical execution of doing that work. Okay, so that's level one. Level two is when we're hiring what I'll call knowledge workers. This is the senior staff in most departments of marketing. They might be a marketing analyst. They might be an accountant, a financial analyst, a sales rep. They're typically degreed. There's a lot of problem solving, analysis, strategic thinking that's involved in the role. I like at this level what I call whiteboarding. Case studies, where literally you just hand the marker to the person in the middle of the interview and go, well, why don't you go up to the whiteboard there and walk us through that? What was the problem? What 3 alternatives did you look at? How did you evaluate each of those? What conclusion did you come to? What worked? What didn't work? And the people who can walk you through this in a logical and rational way, showing you how they solve problems, overcome issues, make recommendations, typically can do a pretty good job with that. And I like to fluctuate back and forth between what have you done that's similar to this kind of a problem or issue? Walk us through that. And then, hey, if you were here two weeks ago, we had to deal with this. You would have been assigned this project. Take us through how you would have set that up and gone through it. So how would you do it? And what have you done that's most similar? Then we come to the last group, which is management team members, executives, directors, VPs, department heads. I think for every one of these folks, they should get a homework assignment, which is where you give them a project. You're actually going to assign them this 2 weeks after they start, so we're just going to accelerate it right into the interview. You give them, 2 to 4 days to work on it, and then you have them come in and make a presentation with their recommendations to your management team. And then maybe it's 45 minutes. They come in with handouts, a PowerPoint, and then you rip it apart. You probe into the details. Why'd you make that assumption? How'd you come to that conclusion? Have you thought through this? And it's a real-time discussion of problem-solving in the interview of something they're going to have to tackle after they come aboard. For example, I'll give a little illustration of how this one works. And to me, this is one of the most powerful elements of interviewing for management-level jobs. I had this client a few years back. They were an airline seating remanufacturer. So major airline would bring in an airplane, take 200 seats out, give them to my client. My client would strip the seats, cut and sew new fabric, put electronics in the back, clean up the seats, give them back to the airline, they put them back on the plane. So they're looking for an operations executive, manager, to run the facility. It's about 80 people, very low tech, cut, sew, light assembly. They've got 2 candidates at the very end of the process. One guy's name is Ben. Ben is this sharp, slick, charismatic, outgoing, friendly guy, 3-piece suit, buttoned up, recently minted MBA, top-tier school, just oozing charisma out of his pores. I mean, you're in love with this guy the second you meet him in the interview. Does a great job interviewing. My client's in love. I thought he was going to hire him on the spot, but he's agreed to go through the whole process. Second candidate comes in, polar opposite of Ben. Great guy. His name's Charlie, but polar opposite of Ben. No formal degree. pulled himself from the bootstraps up, started at the bottom of an aerospace manufacturing company in the machine shop, rose to be the head of operations. Very bright, very capable. Didn't come in a three-piece suit. Came in an open-collared shirt, tattoos down to his wrist. Looks like he just got out of prison. Little bit gruff. Not sure I've ever heard so many F-bombs actually dropped in an interview. But very capable guy. Now we get to the final stage of the interview, the homework assignment. Three significant problems in manufacturing: obsolescence and scrap, on-time deliveries, and throughput in the facility. So the homework assignment is, what's your 30, 60, 90-day plan of how you're going to start to tackle these things and the steps you're going to put in place? Ben comes in. He's got these gorgeous color handouts. He's got this PowerPoint where everybody's just sitting back, drools coming out of their mouth. They're in all, you ever sat one of those PowerPoint presentations where you can almost hear the angels singing in the back? That's kind of what it felt like. I thought my client was going to take the employment agreement and just fling it across the table. Charlie comes in. No handouts, no PowerPoint. He asks for an overhead projector. Now, I got to be real honest with you. I haven't seen an overhead projector since high school, and that's been a few years. But they dig one out of a supply closet. Charlie takes this one clean sheet of acetate, lays it on the top of the overhead projector, and begins to take the management team through a real-time SWOT analysis. Here's what I saw when I was walking around. Here's what we're going to have to do in week one, week two. If this happens or doesn't happen, here's the contingency plan. About 20 minutes into this, the team realizes Ben was full of crap. Great guy. Wonderful guy. No clue what he was talking about. It was all book knowledge, words and terms from school. Never done it, never touched it, never pulled the right levers, but they were awed by his presentation and fell in love with him. Charlie, who they were initially a little bit turned off by from his physical appearance, they realized he had done it multiple times, knew exactly what lever to pull, great team leader, outstanding executive. They completely flip-flopped. Ben went to number two. Charlie went to number one. They hired Charlie, and son of a gun, he did exactly what he said he would do in the homework assignment. To me, that's the beauty of doing those kinds of projects in the interview. You're making it real work as opposed to artificially discussing it. The other strategy at a management level is I like working sessions where the person has actually put a system together, a process, a spreadsheet, a proposal, a set of recommendations, and then to bring those in, that actual document, and work through it together as a real-time session and then figure out how it applies in this new environment. That's a much more insightful assessment of a candidate than asking the 20 standard stupid inane canned interview questions, which people have, you know, come up with their canned responses for. So, in summary, one of your very best strategies in interviewing is to take one-third of the interview, one-third, and make it a real-time test of validating can they do the work. The second thing that I'm going to recommend is that we have a very clear understanding of what we expect in terms of high performance or high success. Not minimum, not average, not what are you going to tolerate that allows people to stay in their job, but what does great success look like? So just this morning, I'm having this conversation with a client of mine back in the Midwest. They have a manufacturing operation. They hire press operators. They've got about 60 of them in their facility, and their hiring success is atrocious. And so we're going through their job description, and it was a lot of minimum, average, mediocre, you know, bottom of the totem pole, kind of tolerated behaviors, attitudes, competencies, and performance. So I said, let's take the things that your very best operators do, the 6 or 9, 10 to 15% of the pool. What do they do that the others don't do? What do you think was the number one thing they mentioned to me? Attendance. The very best show up for work consistently. They're committed to coming to work. Okay, well now how do we define great attendance? What is outstanding attendance for a press operator in a manufacturing facility? You need to be able to articulate that to the candidate. And then what we want to do is dig into, this is, you know, all of you I'm sure are familiar with behavioral interviewing 101. Past performance is the best indicator of future performance. Where have you demonstrated great attendance? So what do those questions sound like? here's our expectation. Tell me where you've met this level of an expectation before. How did your last two companies track attendance? Was there any non-monetary reward and recognition that was given to people who had great attendance records? Where did you fit in that scale? When I call your two previous supervisors from your last two jobs, what will they tell me about your attendance record and where you stacked up against your fellow employees or peers? You know, what we find is life gets in the way a lot of times of getting to work on time. The car won't start, the cat pees on your shoes as you're going out the door, the baby throws up over your shoulder, and you're late for work. Walk me through a couple of examples where life got in the way of you getting to work, and you overcame it and managed to arrive to your shift on time, ready to go, not complaining, on a couple of examples. Take me through that. What you find is when you start to collect this pattern of behavior where people are insanely focused on getting to work on time and that's very important to them, they will continue to replicate it over and over again. But what's the typical interview question around attendance? We expect great attendance. How do you feel about that? Or will you be able to work 45 hours a week and occasional overtime? Sure, no problem. They'll tell you whatever you want to hear. But instead of looking at that, let's focus on where have you actually demonstrated this level of work performance, attendance, initiative, proactivity in the past. So my client says to me this morning, we're still on the subject of defining the criteria. They say to me, our very best press operators are creative problem solvers. I'm like, that's BS. That's up in the clouds. That doesn't make any sense. Give me a precise illustration of what creative problem solving is for a press operator. You got 60 people doing this job. What are the best creative examples? We then spent the next half hour going through example after example of what they defined as creative problem solving. Now you're in the interview. Now you can actually articulate that to the candidate and say, here are two examples from the last 2 months of where our press operators demonstrated creative problem solving in their job, and this is one of our expectations. Can you walk me through a couple of examples where you've done something similar, comparable, or like that? And what you're going to find is people can't make this stuff up fast enough. They've either done it, they've achieved it, they've worked on it, they've been involved in it, or they're just going to stare at you and roll their eyes or give you some kind of answer. So we want to get at what is the criteria we're using to base questions on. Third, and here's the piece that I think will make a dramatic difference in the way you interview people. This is what I tell folks. I usually do this in the last 10 minutes of my presentations, and it is probably the greatest takeaway. There's two steps to this, to getting to the truth. Step number one is ask for examples. Don't accept BS. Don't accept superficial, ambiguous, generic, superficial, 40,000 feet in the air philosophical responses to your questions. Ask for specific examples. Give me one or two examples from this specific job where you illustrated initiative, proactivity, attendance, creative problem solving, the ability to meet these tight tolerances. Whatever the issue is you're trying to measure, ask specifically for an example. That one technique will boost your success in interviewing right through the ceiling. Now, there's a second piece to this. And the second piece is once you get the example, then you want to probe into the details. Don't just accept the example. Probe into the details. When did that happen? Who else was involved? How long did it last? What was the starting point? What was the budget for that? What was the end outcome? How did you measure that? What advice did your boss give you? When I call your boss, when I call the customer, when I talk to one of your peers, is this what they would also tell me? Now, the good news is you don't have to ask 14 or 15 sub-probing questions to get to the truth. What you're going to find is by the third or fourth probing question around each example, it's either going to hang together and you'll realize that's exactly what happened and they were involved in it and I believe it, or they'll self-implode, internally combust, melt down before your very eyes. and it's really sticky and messy when that occurs. You, as I said earlier, in 30 years of doing this and thousands of interviews, I have never found a candidate that can make this stuff up fast enough, no matter what level job they're at. So those are some overall techniques to interviewing. We've developed an interview structure over the last 20-plus years that basically is five interview questions, just five, that will get you 80 to 90% of the way there in terms of information you're trying to collect in the interview. Let me cycle through each of those five interview questions. Interview question number one. Let me back up for a minute. There's five criteria that lead to the interview questions. Let me go through the criteria. Number one, high initiative. The very best performers, whether they're at minimum wage or they're senior executives, demonstrate high self-motivation, initiative, and proactivity. It is the number one, bar none, number one criteria for success. It overcomes lack of education, not going to the right schools. It overcomes growing up on the wrong side of the tracks, not having the greatest company backgrounds on your resume. People who show initiative go head and shoulders above others. I'll give you a quick illustration of this. And it's age independent, by the way. It's a pattern of life. Doesn't matter whether you're 13, 35, 55. It's something you carry forward through your entire life. So one of the things I do, in addition to coaching and consulting with companies around their hiring processes, executive search, those kind of things, I coach high school girls basketball, and I've been doing it for over a decade. So here we are. We're in summer. We're bringing in a new group of girls. I've got 14 that have just come out of middle school. And the very first thing I look at in the first few seconds of a brand new practice with a brand new group of girls is who's got initiative and self-motivation. So what happens? It's 30 seconds before the whistle blows to start practice. I got 12 girls sitting on the floor, still tying their shoelaces, and three have already been up for 15 minutes working on jump shots and free throws. The whistle blows, practice ends, 12 of the girls have their flip-flops on and they're out the door in the blink of an eye. But three or four stayed behind to work, go one-on-one against each other and work on their dribbling and shooting. Now, I know those three or four are not as talented as some of the other girls who ran out the door right away. But those three or four girls will bypass their more talented peers within 1 to 2 years by getting more play time, more significant experience, and move up to higher level teams at a faster rate than their peers because they apply themselves with initiative and proactivity. I've seen this in religious institutions. I've seen it in nonprofits. I've seen it in school, work, social situation. It doesn't matter what it is. Sports, you name it, the people who show initiative and proactivity far exceed their peers. It's the number one thing we should be measuring. Number two, flawless execution. This doesn't mean that someone does their job perfectly. It means they get their job done. In most companies, there's a multitude of crap that gets in the way of doing your work. Problems, mistakes, errors, departments that don't cooperate, vendors and suppliers that don't deliver stuff on time. And the most successful people don't allow those to stymie them. They build contingency plans, they find creative solutions, they go around those, and they go to their boss and they deliver it every single time, on budget, within expectations. Instead of coming to you, like most subordinates do, and taking the monkey off their back and putting it on your back. Oh, boss, I couldn't get this done because X, because Y. What do we call those? Excuses and explanations. The very best don't give excuses and explanations. They get it done. So flawless execution is an important element of great success. Number three, in our five-point list. Number three, at a managerial level and above, leadership. The ability to hire, retain, coach, motivate, bring people from previous jobs onto their teams. Folks, the best folks follow them because they want to work for them. Their people go out and take greater responsibility on in the department or within the organization. They're outstanding as managers, leaders, supervisors. If you're hiring people at an individual contributor level, I recommend we measure personal leadership. And I define personal leadership as the ability to subordinate your own personal ego and needs to be a great teammate, to go above and beyond the call of duty in helping either specific teammates or the entire team to be more successful. You got a customer service group of three people. You're hiring a newbie into the group. Two of the people in the group play, let's sabotage the newbie and see how quickly they fail. One person goes, you know, I know it's important for all of us to succeed. Let me put my arm around this person's shoulders and show them how we get things done here. Now, that person knows their boss isn't going to pat them on the back. They may not have even noticed it was going on. They're not going to get a raise through it, but they recognize how important it is for each member of the team to be successful. My question is, in interviews where teamwork is important to get things done, and we're hiring people at non-leadership or management levels, do we measure selfless behavior as a teammate? Number four. And this number four piece is probably 80% of the interview. Their past successes are comparable, similar, and like what you need done in the job. I would say the number one reason hiring failure occurs is because we don't define, document, quantify, measure, and articulate well enough what we want people to do for us. And then we don't measure what they've done that's similar, comparable, and like that. So that is 80% of the interview. That's what I talked about at the very beginning. What is a tendency issue as a metric? Is it the ability to drive year-over-year sales growth by double-digit levels, at least for a 2 to 3 year period? What have they done that's similar, comparable, and like that? You're hiring a sales rep. You want someone who's going to get you double-digit growth year-over-year for at least 3 years in this territory, and your criteria is you had to have been in an organization where you got it at least 2 years in a row, double-digit sales growth. So you say to the candidate, you know, we need someone who can drive double-digit sales growth. Oh, yeah, no problem. I can do that. I've done it before. Check mark, move on. No, that's not what you would do. You would say to the candidate, all right, take me through this job. You were there for 3 years. What were sales at the end of 2014? What were sales at the end of 2015? What were sales at the end of 2016 in your territory? Wait a minute, I'm confused. You said you drove double-digit sales growth, but when we add this up, it looks like you got -5, it was flat this year, and you got 7% this year. That's not double-digit growth. Have I missed something? For some reason, I find most hiring managers are unwilling to dig, probe, and ask precise questions to validate someone's success. We just take the superficial first blush statement and accept it as the given truth. What percentage embellish and exaggerate and lie? 120 to 140%. So the only way to get to the truth is to dig into this. Now, one of the complaints I hear back a lot of times is many hiring managers say to me, gosh, that feels like rubber hoses and bright lights. It feels like I'm berating the candidate. It seems almost humiliating asking candidates these specific questions. You can do it in a conversational tone. It doesn't have to come across like a police interrogation. It can be asked very softly and very gently and conversationally in a relationship-based kind of conversation, but it's still the exact same question. What were your sales at the end of 2014? Now take me through it. What was it at the end of 2015? It's the same question, it's just being asked in a different tone. So in the slide deck that I'm going to send you, I show what three or four of these core questions are around each of these, and then I show, you know, what should you be measuring, what should you be looking for in the responses. All right, last one, number five in the list, and this rarely gets dug into, and it's one of the most significant reasons for failure in hiring, is what I call adaptability. Many candidates who have the same exact job title, come out of a direct competitor doing the same thing you do, still fail. How is that possible? It's because the environment they were in is so radically different from yours, they can't adapt. And what are those elements of those environments or cultures? Pace, energy, rigor, reporting, resources, level of change, size. We sometimes take examples from candidates, this is the behavioral interviewing piece, without understanding the context or the environment that it occurred in. And where the mistake most readily or most commonly appears is in sales hiring. We assume that if you're out of a similar industry and you've had a similar job title, you should be able to do our job. And nothing could be further from the truth. You know, in that environment, 70% of their opportunities came from leads the company generated through their website and inbound marketing and gave to the candidate. In your environment, 70% of the opportunities have to come from cold calling and self-generated leads. Person's going to fail miserably. Or they tell you, con you, that they're a hunter and they can go out and close deals. But the reality is the two deals they closed last year actually were brought forward by the president of the company and they had nothing to do with it. So we have to understand that environment of how did it come together, what's the pace, what's the energy level, what was their exact contribution versus somebody else's contribution. I mean, the gross example of this is size. You're a 17-person organization and you're looking at a candidate coming out of a 500-person organization. The risk of failure is probably enormous. In your environment, you're working out of this office suite where if the toilet paper runs out in the bathroom, somebody's got to change it. But when you're in a 500 to 1,000-person organization, there's a whole fleet of custodians running around doing that for you. Now, I know that's kind of a gross example to give, but it's not good or bad. It's just a different culture and environment. And many people look at these things sometimes, particularly in smaller, more entrepreneurial settings or emerging growth settings, startups, as that's below me. I did that 5 years ago. I shouldn't have to do those things again. So it's important to measure what's that underlying environment and how similar or dissimilar from your environment is it. And then to ask yourself, what's the risk of that in terms of size, scope, effort, pace? Let's say your pace is right through the ceiling. You're on a rocket ride. And they're coming out of an environment that's a country clubbish, relaxed, soft, non-change-oriented environment. They're probably going to fail in their first week. Five simple things to measure to probably get at 80 to 85% of the information you need to make a hiring decision or at least move forward in the process. The last thing I'm going to recommend, and then we'll throw it open to questions, is that in addition to having an interview guide, so every candidate interviewed for that job gets asked the same set of questions, is some kind of scoring tool. And I'm going to send all of you the vanilla one that we've created. We call it the 8-point success matrix. I'm going to suggest that this one-page little scoring tool that has 8 core items on it in the same framework that I've just walked you through is the one thing that our clients think is the best thing we've ever created in 30 years. Because in one little page that takes about 3 minutes to score, at the end of an interview, it brings this entire session that we've spent almost 45 minutes together talking through on how to interview, it brings it all together on this one little page. And you can compare hiring manager by hiring manager assessment, and you can compare candidate by candidate. So if you think of this entire process as kind of a set of bookends, you know, the first bookend on the left-hand side is your definition of success. The bookend on the right-hand side is your 8-point success matrix that validates they can hit the goals and objectives, outcomes, deliverables, expectations you want, and your interview guide is the piece that bridges between those two bookends. Dana, I'll turn it back to you.
Before we open up the line for people to ask questions of Barry, Barry, could you take a minute and talk about Barry has this program that some of you may not need a high-end recruiter, or maybe you're not paying at a level where you'd need a high-end recruiter, but you still need help in identifying where to find these people, which is a bear. Barry and I had a 5-minute conversation on that before we started the program today. Where do you hunt for people? Because getting so many bad candidates off the old way of doing things. So Barry has a program. It's up to 10 hours. Is that correct, Barry?
Yeah. So what I find with a lot of my clients is they don't need me to do executive search for them, or they can't afford it. They're not big enough. You know, you got to be a $20+ million company with a fair amount of cash in the bank to afford an executive search fee that's going to be $30,000 to $60,000 or some variation in there. So you don't always need that. Or you got your own network of folks that are coming forward in the process. But you still need help in the process. How do you define success? How do you write something compelling that gets the very best people to raise their hand? And I'll tell you right now, that job description that most people post as their ad is a disgusting, revolting, disgusting, repulsive document that turns the best people off. So we need something more compelling to bring them forward. What does that look like? Most people struggle to write that. But once they do it the first time, the rest are pretty easy. And then what does an interview guide look like to actually validate and verify and vet that what we want done, this person can actually do for us? Doesn't matter whether it's an administrative role that you're paying minimum wage to, or it's a senior executive member of the team that you're paying a couple hundred grand to. The process and the steps are exactly the same. So I charge $2,500. It's 10 hours of work. Typically, each role takes about 5 hours. And my experience over 30 years has been is once we do a couple of these together, then you don't need Barry Deutsch. Now you have a great framework to apply this to any kind of role you might hire for the future.
And we have a number of clients that have used Barry's service on that. They actually only use maybe 2 or 3 hours for a specific position, and then they bank it.
Right, so as I thank you, Dana. So I tell my clients there is no expiration date on the hours. I have some clients that, you know, 2 years ago we did the project, and now they're calling back saying, hey, we got this other role. Could you help us with that?
Great program.
Thank you, Dana.
Just phenomenal, and it's inexpensive, and Barry will help brainstorm where to find people. I can tell you story after story of some of these crazy things Barry has come up with that I would highly recommend. So we're going to close down this portion of our program in just a second. First, I want to thank Barry very much for being on the program again. You've been, from the very beginning, a part of OpenLine. So you've been doing this for over a decade, Barry.
Hard to believe.
Also, I want to invite all of you. Will be sending out the invite shortly for our February 22nd OpenLine program, The Secrets of High Growth Companies, How Best-in-Breed Organizations Separate from the Pack. There'll be another terrific program. We're also going to be sending out, or Barry's going to send to each of you a packet from today and also his book. I highly recommend you read the entire book because it's, as I mentioned earlier, it's like the Bible of hiring. It's just phenomenal. So I'm going to turn off the recording feature, and then I'm going to open up the line for anyone that has questions. We have a number of people on today, so I would ask you all to put your phone on mute, not on hold, but put it on mute because we don't want to hear music from your hold system. Put it on mute and then unmute if you have a question for Barry. So give me just a second here. We'll close off this portion of it, and we'll be right back.